Why do we sing? Not just at church, but in general. Maybe some of you don't. You should start. Well, sometimes we sing because we're happy, because things are going as we would have hoped that they would go. Sometimes we sing because of victory. I'm not talking about that horrible Dodgers rendition of We Are the Champions back in the 80s, but that's one example. One of my sons was on a baseball team a couple years back. They had a young man on it that after every game that they won, now these are 12-year-olds, mind you, he would walk out of the dugout rolling a speaker behind him blasting, "All I do is win, 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 win." Obnoxious, no doubt, but you got the point. That is for sure. Other times we sing not because we're happy, but because we're hurting or we're overwhelmed. Or lonely. I mean, as Elton John sang, sad songs do say so much. I mean, the blues, for instance, is an American genre that captures this reality very well. You know, what are the blues, according to Muddy Waters? It has to do with a woman leaving a man and not under the best of circumstances. One attempt to define it, maybe a little more precise than Muddy Waters, is this. Blues is traveling by Greyhound bus, that counts, but not traveling by plane. Driving Chevys, Fords, or any broken-down truck, and an occasional Cadillac qualifies, but driving Volvos and BMWs does not. The blues may be found in such places as a jailhouse or a morgue, a room with an empty bed, a back highway, or at the bottom of an empty bottle, but not at Nordstrom's or the mall, a gallery opening, or the golf course. All this to say is that we sing for all sorts of reasons, in good times and in bad, but today I want us to look at a singer in this particular text who comes to church every week and sings his heart out. I want us to hear his song, and in hearing it, I want us to see that we have every reason now to sing. No matter what kind of week we've had, no matter what sort of circumstances in your life have led you to this place, there's a reason even for us in this present day with all the heartache, with all the unknown, and all the uncertainty of the future, where we can put our stake in the ground and sing joyfully and confidently about victory. And so with that in mind, I want us to see in Hebrews chapter 2, the first thing is when expectation doesn't meet reality. When expectation doesn't meet reality. We are presented in this text with two things that kind of smack us in the face immediately. We are presented with the original intent and calling of man, the expectation or the original calling of man. He's created a little lower than the angels, or even in the Hebrew, a little lower than the gods. He's crowned with glory and honor from Psalm 8. He's set over all of the works that God has made. Everything that God put out in the world, he subjected to this particular creature, saying, "You are the ruler and king over these things." Most of us know the story. We understand the story of man at creation. And as we hear the description of who we are as made in the image of God, we cannot help but be swept up in kind of the grandeur of the narrative, or at least what was proposed to be our story as men and women and boys and girls. Man and mankind is a crown prince, an heir of the whole world, according to the story. His crown contains jewels of glory and honor, and he's given authority that is so far-ranging that he is allowed to rule over every single thing that the great king spoke into existence. Nothing is kept back from man. Everything is subject to him. I mean, that is what we are made for. That is the great expectation that hangs over your life. Now consider that and think of your Monday through Saturday. It doesn't quite live up to this fact that we are indeed royals, as Lord says. It does run in our blood, literally. We're made in the image of God. And your place of rule was to be the entirety of God's three-storied house. That's the expectation, but notice in the text, back to reality. In verses 8 and verses 14 and 15, we see this problem. Immediately, he says, we do not see everything subject to him in verse 8. We are not told why. We're just told that there is a problem that is evident to everyone who is looking. A world meant to be ruled by man is clearly not subject to man's desires. You don't have to be deeply theological to see this. I mean, the world is amiss. It is amiss with war and natural disaster and disease. There's massive inequalities in the world. We have hatred. There's extreme partisanship even in our own country. There are broken families, broken bodies, broken lives, broken hearts. The whole thing, everything is broken. Bob Dylan said that. And he was right. In verses 14 and 15, it speaks clearly to the brokenness. Notice, there is one who has power through death, the devil. It tells us in verses 14 and 15 that man, this creature that was created to live life as a dominator, one who subjected the world to himself, instead is living in fear of death. These people who were created to be royalty, notice, they are all lifelong living as slaves, cowering before the expectation that an end hangs over them that they cannot stop or control or keep from coming. I mean, the grim irony is that those made as crowned rulers of creation are shown here in this text as cowering, shivering slaves under the rule of another creature, something made by God, not their creator, Satan himself. I mean, the about face in the text is severe. And what we should see from it is that things are not as they're supposed to be, that we were not made for this, but this is what we're living like. This is a sort of pain. This reality, at least, breeds the sort of pain that the blues are born out of. As one author writes, I can now imagine a congregation in Alan Lomax's Mississippi Delta, a congregation of sharecroppers and slave descendants in the 1930s, a congregation of men who must call the plantation owner's 10-year-old son, Mister, while he calls them boy, a congregation of orphaned children and widowed women and abandoned wives and disillusioned men, a congregation of men and women of sorrows, a congregation of human beings barely clinging to their humanity. And they're singing, I'll Fly Away, in that clapboard church, and they're clapping and stomping out the beat, and they're waiting for some glad day when they cross the golden shore, waiting for Sunday to come, waiting for the man of sorrows, whose mercy knows no bounds. While we don't all experience it surely in just that way, we do experience some of the pain and the disconnect between how life was supposed to be and how it actually is in our present case. And because of that, there's this longing that's built into all of us as human creatures, that we just want things to be right. Even if we don't even know what the right is, we understand that something is broken and things have gone awry, and we want it desperately to be fixed. Well, if that's the expectation versus reality, the second thing I want us to see is when reality doesn't meet reality. What happens when the solution to the problem becomes a large part of the problem itself? Because that's what happens in the book of Hebrews here. They're offered a solution to their brokenness, but the offer makes their life worse, and it makes the brokenness become all the more apparent in their daily life. I mean, this author is telling the story to a group of people who have already been freed from the tyranny of the devil, who have proclaimed that Christ really is the King, who've given themselves to the Creator of the universe as His children. And in response to that giving of themselves, they have brought on all manner of suffering and persecution and are now afraid that their lives may be in jeopardy as the Roman government threatens their very existence because of their false claim that Jesus Christ is Lord instead of Caesar being Lord. They have a group of Jewish persecutors who despise the fact that they've left their Judaism and their heritage and have proclaimed Christ as a Messiah. And from all sides, they are being pressured. And all because they have done what they thought would solve their big problem. They've come to Christ as a Savior and a restorer of their humanity. I mean, the Church of Hebrews is facing severe persecution, so severe that some have already abandoned the faith, have gone back to temple worship, and said that Jesus just doesn't fix the problem. Maybe you've experienced that, where you wonder if it's worth it at all. When the author is writing to this group and exhorting them not to follow their former members into apostasy. But his words, his encouragement, don't seem, at least at face value, to match the life they're living. I mean, can you relate to that emotional tension at all? I mean, your enemy is defeated. Well, then, why does he seem to be so successful? You know, you watch the news. You've read the paper. You see what seems to be the future. And it doesn't seem the enemy's defeated. It seems he's just fine. that business is booming. The author tells us that we no longer need to fear when it would seem there's plenty to fear. I mean, think of your own life. There's plenty of unknowns that seem real, and that fear seems to be an appropriate emotional response and even appropriate intellectual response to the facts that are presented. You have victory over sin, the Bible tells us. And why does it seem like it has so much victory over us? Why are there certain things that just won't go away? No matter how many times you've repented, no matter how many times you've been caught, no matter how many times you in all sincerity have said, that is it, no more. Why does it seem to have the upper hand in that particular area of your life? The Bible tells us God is our shield and our great reward. And why does it feel then that we're so vulnerable and so undervalued all at the same time? You know, it's those kind of tensions that require an answer. And not the cute, sentimental Christian slogan kind of answers, you know. This is no time for a poster of a cat tangled in a ball of yarn that, you know, says, let go and let God. Those sort of answers won't do. You know, the glad game won't do this kind of heavy lifting. When you see the way that the world is, and then you see what God's Word says about your particular life and how it's supposed to be going. So what do you do? I mean, where do you look when what is apparent and seemingly actual conflicts with what God has promised? What is the appropriate response when life, the life of faith, doesn't look like a victory march, but more like a cold and a broken hallelujah? It is just that tension that the author wants to answer in this text. And the answer he gives is not trite, it's not make-believe, it's not just, you know, some well-wishing to get you through the day. It's not an answer that ignores pain, but it's an answer that, if believed by faith, should bring great comfort and confidence to those in the faith, even in the midst of the worst of trials. So the final thing I want us to see is when our reality is another's reality. You know, we have expectation, what man's supposed to be in the reality that is, and then we have our salvation with God is saying certain things are a reality and they don't seem to match up with the way that our life is. So what's the hope in the midst of that? It's basically this: when our reality is another's reality. Notice what the author does. He wants to make sure that we see that Jesus shares with us. The first thing he shows is that he shared in our humanity. One can't help but see the identification of Christ with his people in this chapter. Look at verse 11 and 14 and 17. The consecrated one and those who are being consecrated are all of one stock. They are sharers in the same nature. Verse 14, children partake of flesh and blood. He himself likewise shared in the same. In 17, all things he had to be made like unto his brethren. It is clear that Jesus partook of our nature. And the author is stressing to this congregation how deep this identity with Christ and man goes. It goes so deep that they are sharers of one and the same humanity. It's not that Jesus was kind of human. He shared in our bodily realities. He was fully man. And in this sense, Jesus really is one of the guys. He understands the dilemma that you're in. And this is important for us to know in the midst of trial. Why? Because notice the next thing he shares in. Jesus shared in the reality of suffering. Just as clearly as we're told he was a human, we are also told that part of the human condition that he fully shared in was the suffering that humans endure in this age. To a church in the midst of great suffering and persecution, fearing the loss even of their lives, torn from home and family and the land of the living, the author begins to systematically show that Jesus identifies with their suffering, and not just a little bit, but he understands the depths of their condition. Verse 10, it is fitting to make the champion of their salvation perfect through suffering. Verse 14, that through his death he might destroy him who had the power of death. Verse 18, he himself suffered being tested. Jesus was not only truly human, but as a man, despite his sinlessness, he too suffered greatly. He was tested like they were, except he was tested so far that he took death as the result of the testing. Now, in our day, we are indeed heavy on empathy, which is important. Empathy is a wonderful condition to have. If you want any friends, if you want your marriage to survive, you should learn the skill of being empathetic. But some feel that a problem is resolved if we can just show the person struggling that others have gone through the same trial. Have you ever had this? You know, you're sharing your struggle and then someone one-ups your struggle. Like, oh, I had that same thing too, but so much worse. I had that operation. It was brutal, but, you know, both of my arms were, you know, amputated. I was engaged once too, been there, you know, bought the t-shirt. We all hurt. And while that's good, it is good to have someone that understands your condition, just understanding or just entering in doesn't solve your problem. I'm sure you've felt that before. Where someone is able to put their arm around you, they're able to understand, but that doesn't mean that at that moment then the pain goes away because you're both in pain. That doesn't, you know, two negatives do not equal a positive in that particular equation. If that is how the story ends, you may feel related to, but you'll never feel rescued. I mean, Hebrew church, I know you're stressed about your situation, but don't worry. Jesus was stressed too. You know, you may feel threatened and about to die, but don't worry. I mean, Jesus was crucified. That may be true, but it is cold comfort if that's all that's being offered here. So why these observations? What do they lead to? To this final thing. That Jesus doesn't just share in their humanity. He doesn't just share in their suffering. He shares his reality of victory in life with them. But it's a two-way exchange. We began by looking at the created purpose of man, which has seriously gone awry. He was created to be crowned with glory and honor, but here is a church that believes in Jesus that is shamed and suffering. They're not dwelling in glory. They're not being honored. And he was created, man was created to rule the world, but here we see a church being dominated and persecuted by others. Man was created for life, but here we see the redeemed threatened with death and now subject to slavish fear because of it. And all that they were supposed to be anyway seems lost. But the author of Hebrews says we're not looking in the right place. You're not looking, you are looking merely at the apparent reality, but you're not seeing reality. And so what he tells them to do is he says you need to see something else. You need to see Jesus. Notice verse 9, but we do see him in reference to Jesus. And we see him. He's crowned with glory and honor. Yes, he suffered, but for this purpose, in order to taste death for us on our behalf. The far-reaching implications of the incarnation, says the author, is this, that Jesus was made man. He suffered, yes, even to death. But he goes on to show us that that is not where the story ends. In fact, the story of Jesus' humanity continues even today. Today, Jesus, the man, is crowned with glory and honor. Today, Jesus, the fully embodied, resurrected human, sits at the right hand of God the Father, ruling all power and all authority. And while that may not seem like an immediate help to your crisis, it is in fact what the author wants us to see in this way, that this reality of rule and honor and glory is our reality. Because Jesus is crowned now. Today he rules all things. But that is not all. It's not just that he does those things. You'll notice the author says, and he's not ashamed to call us brothers. And that is the hint that the author wants us to see, is that becomes the hope in the midst of time of trial. That the author's assurance is this. It is a fact that Jesus joined us here as a man of sorrows, but it is also a fact that we will be joined intimately to all of his rewards and joys. That just as he suffered, yes, we suffer, but what we see now, we see a man resurrected and ruling and honored and joyful. That much we will share with him as well. As surely as we suffer, so surely will we reign and rule and enjoy the life that he now enjoys in resurrection. Christ did all of this sharing with us of our humanity and our suffering, in order that he might freely and graciously share all of his victory with us. And even though ours was the sin and his was the pain, even though we did all the destroying and he did all of the overcoming, he is not ashamed to look at you now in whatever condition you're in and call you his brother. He sees how the story ends. He sees you right next to him, crowned with glory and honor. He sees you truly human for the first time in your life. Regardless of what your present condition is, he sees the glory of the resurrection that he's earned on your behalf. And to a church in the midst of suffering, tempted to be ashamed of the name of Christ, tempted to look at the Christian life as a farce and unworthy of all the effort, they are reminded that Christ, though clothed as a man, though suffering, though he has done all this heavy lifting, all because we completely failed to live up to our calling as man, this Christ who died in your stead has been raised to glory. And because he's been raised to glory, you will as well. This Christ is not ashamed, but he is proud to call you brothers. He never gets embarrassed when he sees you coming around. He never makes excuses for being on your side. He's just fine with being associated with you as his children. So much so that he calls you by all the family names he can think of. And not only that, he sings this reality with and to us this morning. You'll notice as we close this morning in verse 12, what this looks like. In verses 12 and 13, Jesus doesn't blush to identify himself with his people. All three times, you notice they contain these personal affirmations. I will proclaim, I will sing, I will trust, here I am, and the children whom you've given me. All of these texts taken from the Old Testament, I can't go into all the detail, but we at least know Psalm 22, which is the first quote, a psalm of suffering and degradation, a psalm of seeming abandonment that ends in joy. There's a turn in Psalm 22 where we see God's redemption. God has answered him and saved him, and the response is he declares God's name in the company of God's people, in the midst of his brethren. That Christ, according to this text, because the whole of Psalm 22 is about Jesus, according to that text, when you sing this morning, Christ is in the midst of the assembly, and he is singing his guts out because he knows about the redemption of God. All those songs you sing every Lord's Day, after every Lord's Day, those hymns and the psalms, are songs that are first sung by Jesus, and the reason that has to be true, the reason it's so important that that is true, is because there are times when you will sing those songs and you will wonder if it's really so. I mean, does God really forgive me like this song says? Is there really a resurrection from the dead? Is there really life after this time of trial? And there's one who shows up every Lord's Day singing above the whole of the crowd at the top of his lungs because he's already lived out the story. He knows the songs are true. And according to this text, he leads you in singing them every week. So even if you can't believe them, he has already believed and performed them on your behalf in order that you might join in and see the truth of them in him. That all that he shared in your humility, he plans on sharing back with you in glory. And we know that because even now he speaks of you and looks at you as altogether glorious and lovely. He calls us then this morning, people of God, to join his song. Because you are joined to him. He calls you to look at him. And what do you see? We see Jesus. And what is he doing? He's singing. And he's singing because he won. Because it's over. Because the trials and the tribulations are gone and paths of victory he has walked. And he invites you to join in that chorus of the song because even though you're not experiencing it yet, it is your reality and it's promised to you through his death and resurrection. May you believe it this morning, and even as we close and singing in his supper, may you hear his voice and join in his confidence, for he indeed has done it all for you. Let us pray. This morning, as we gather together as God's people, we do gather to sing his praises, but even as we heard this morning, even God in human flesh is in our midst, and he is singing. You know, and his song is a song of victory. He is done. There's no more work for him to complete. He sings because he knows how the story ends, and according to the prophets, he sings over you because he's delighted in you. And he's delighted in you not because of your performance, but because of what he has done on your behalf and what he sees you will be at the resurrection. He has done all that is necessary to conform you into his own image, to one that will be crowned with glory and honor and will be pleasing to the Father, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing. But between now and that day, he has given us this meal to strengthen us for the way. We can't quite sing all of those victory songs without a little bit of struggle, and yet God himself is here today to show us exactly what we need to get from here to there. We need Christ, not something like him. We need Christ and holy him. And in bread and wine this day, by the promise of the Spirit, God himself says that he will meet us and feed us this day to give us strength for our heavenly journey. So may you come to this table today to be fortified, to be fed, to see Christ and to taste him, and indeed to know that he is good to his people.